evening, everyone. It's great to see you all here. Thank you so much for coming. Those of you who I don't know, I'm Hussein Naji. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy here at the LSC. And I'm absolutely thrilled to be welcoming Dr. John Ioannidis, who's a professor at the at Stanford University in the US. He's a professor of statistics, medicine, health policy, data science, and the list goes on, with many honorary positions elsewhere in the world in many very prestigious universities. And he is one of the most highly cited researchers in the world. So it's an absolute honor to be welcoming him to the LSC to hear more about his latest research around meta research. So thank you so much, John, for coming. And just a quick note that this session will be recorded and will be made into a podcast afterwards. So with that, we'll start. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hussein. Thank you for the very kind invitation, and thank you for finding time, all of you, to be here late in the evening. For meta research. Meta research. What is meta research? It sounds a little bit like Meta, that is doing very badly at the moment. But hopefully, meta research is doing a bit better. Meta research is research on research. It goes back to the origins of the scientific method. And research is how we try to get to science. Science is the best thing that can happen to us, to know and to act based on knowledge and evidence. Research clearly needs to be supported with heightened commitments. We all believe that research is a good thing, especially when it's for our own labs, it's even better. And most research done to date has been, unfortunately, non-transparent. Much of that has not been reproducible. There's lots of people who are concerned that this may be a problem, and it may be in the way of optimizing that knowledge and what we can make out of that knowledge. Here's how science looks like. We have about 35 million authors who have published at least one scientific paper. About 9+ million have published 5 papers, so they're a bit deeper in the business. And we have about 200 million scholarly documents. Most of them claim that they have something important to say, something novel to say. The rate is increasing at about 6+ million per year. So it's a vast and expanding universe. And each paper, especially in some biomedical fields, but also others now, can include up to millions of results, or it could include millions of hidden results, and you know, some that are more visible. So if you multiply that, we're in the range of potentially billions and trillions of results that comprise science and research products. This is an early paper that we wrote along with Dan Fanelli, who I see here. He's at LSC after moving from Stanford to a better place. We tried to put together some thoughts about what should be under the rubric of meta research, what should be included under that term. And we said, well, it could be anything that is related to how we perform research, how we communicate research, how we verify research, how we evaluate research, and how we reward research. So it's about methods, and methods could be like any science. Reporting, again, very important for all types of science. Reproducibility, it's a very central issue that has acquired tremendous importance, has become a buzzword in the last several years, with thoughts about a reproducibility crisis that we are suffering from, but with debates about whether that's really a crisis, whether that's how it used to be all the time, but we just see it now. Maybe it's not that bad, or maybe it's horrible. Evaluation. How to evaluate research, and that opens up clearly a can of worms when you think about how we do this, how we do peer review at all levels, in early stages, at the level of having a paper being published, at the level of the paper hasn't been published, but still there's room to have post-publication peer review. Also funding, very sensitive, and how to evaluate scientific quality. I mean, that word is a killer, because if you ask me what is quality, I have to say, I don't know. We have to operationalize it and find some way to agree on what that means. And finally, incentives, which I think are very central, because we all want to get the best research, we all want to get the best science, but the question is, how do we incentivize that? And I think that this is the best place to think about incentives and how do we find ways to get to that goal. I will start from the central goal, which is reproducibility, and it's a term that has been very, very prominent in the literature. This is another paper where Dan was also involved. This is some text mining of all scientific fields, all major fields, ranging from mathematics, computer science, up to, I don't remember what MU is.
Multidisciplinary.
Multidisciplinary, okay. Nature. Yes. So all fields are talking more about reproducibility of results or other terms related to reproducibility. But then the question is, what is reproducibility? And this is trying to break it down into three big categories: reproducibility of methods, reproducibility of results, and reproducibility of inferences. Reproducibility of methods is mostly about reading the method section. Sometimes it's fine print, sometimes it's somewhere in some appendix or supplementary file and the link doesn't work, but then you open it and you try to understand what happened here. Is it understandable? Can I resurrect it? Can I make it happen again? It's like finding some bones from a dinosaur and you want to use the DNA to create the Jurassic Park dinosaur life again. And very often that dinosaur cannot be resurrected. You know, it's just dry bones. And what did they do here? If it's wet lab, you try again and again in the lab. You cannot make it work. If it's social sciences, some interesting details are missing. If it's clinical medicine, some more than just interesting results or details in the methods are missing. Reproducibility of results is about getting another study, not the first one, but a second study or a third study, and trying to see if I follow the methods and what happened in the first one, either very faithfully, and that would be exact replication, or maybe modifying it a little bit, do I get the same results? Do I get similar results? Do I get consistent results? There's at least 27 statistical methods to decide whether the results are consistent enough. But this is the gist. So yet other studies, and do they agree or not with what I did before? And finally, reproducibility of inferences. You have 1, 2, 5, 20, 1,000 studies, and you get some experts or the best experts or the experts of experts or a group of people who need to discuss and arbitrate on these results. And what do they conclude? Do they recommend for the medication to be licensed? Do they say that this has been proven? It's final. We don't need any more research. Or no, it's very early. This is very early in the game. We need to do more studies and so forth. So do we make knowledge claims of similar strength or not similar strength from one or more studies and study replications? There's differences across fields that affect what reproducible research means. And each one of us may have their hands on one or more subfields of science. I tend to mess in many different fields, and the rules are not the same. Also, the expectations are not the same. The degree of determinism, the signal to measurement error ratio, the complexity of the designs that are standard and accepted in the field, and also the measurement tools, the closeness of fit between hypothesis and experimental design, the statistical analysis methods that are used to test hypotheses, or whether even hypotheses are being tested to start with. What is typical heterogeneity? Do people love heterogeneity? Do they hate heterogeneity? Do they make a living and a career out of heterogeneity? Whether there's a culture of replication, transparency, and accumulating knowledge, or what are criteria, statistical criteria, for making truth claims, or this is shown or not shown? And finally, is that a field that is about curiosity, about galaxies that are 6,000 light years away? Or is it about something that has practical implications, that is about life and death? It's going to be about people dying or living longer. What are the consequences of getting it wrong, of false conclusions? Is it just curiosity, or is it applied? I would discuss some stereotypes that I don't have any particular researcher or scientific field in mind, but these are common stereotypes that we see across many research enterprises and subfields of science. The typical recipe that is more dominant in most fields is working with small data. We have lots of smart people who want to do research. We have limited funds, unfortunately. If you divide them across all these smart people, the amount of funding is limited per researcher. Therefore, the sample size of the studies that are done tends to be pretty small. People learn that they need to become independent. This means that they tend to be siloed and work on their own, solo siloed investigators with small teams. They need to convince the funding agencies every now and then that they have found something important. You cannot go to the funding agency saying that my research has been a failure and I didn't find anything, but I want more money to make sure that I find nothing. This means that there is a lot of cherry picking, conscious or unconscious or subconscious, to try to paint narratives that look very nice. Much of that is done post hoc. It's not confirmation, it's not pre-registered research. It's research also that uses p-values of just less than 0.05 being enough, and with a little bit of p-hacking, any p-value can go to that right place. And no sharing, because this is giving ammunition to competitors. No replication, because the feeling is that if I try to replicate and it doesn't show me the same signal, then I'm back to square zero. No one will want to publish something that is a null finding. Wrong mentality. I'm not saying that this is the way that it should be, but it's very pervasive. And again, this is just a too stereotypical picture, but I think it's pretty common and pervasive. There's also another stereotype, which is about big data, that is becoming more prominent in several scientific fields, like omics or working with electronic health records for healthcare and medical care. And here we have very rich data. We have lots of observations, which could pertain to millions of people, like electronic health records, or it could pertain to a single individual, but I have measured my genome and my transcriptome and my every ohm. So then, I still need to come up with a narrative with something interesting to say. So out of these millions and billions of results, some results need to be cherry-picked, to be highlighted. Much of that is still done post hoc, maybe no pre-registration again. Statistical tools tend to be more sophisticated because there's lots of smart people who have thought about how to deal with such huge data sets and what is the most efficient way to do this, but they tend to be idiosyncratic. People use some techniques in one subfield of omics, and for example, a neighboring subfield may be using different techniques, even though they look very similar in terms of their statistical underbelly. And more sharing is happening, but that sharing is not such that might be very meaningful very often, because these data are not only very rich, they tend to be very complex. No one can understand unless you give them very specific instructions about what these variables mean, how they were collected, what might be caveats about the data collection. I mean, any of you who might have looked at electronic health records, they look so nice, but then when you start doing some pure logic checks, you find people with prostate cancer who are women, and then you find people who they're not diabetic, but their glucose is seven times off the roof, or you have find people who are 172 years old. I mean, this is just common occurrences. So unless you know exactly how these data were collected, who collected them, how, and how they're operationalized, people may use them without knowing that, and they can come up with a huge mess. Now, the prototype or the stereotype of small data, as I said, is very pervasive. This is a paper we published several years ago looking at different areas of neuroscience, ranging from basic science all the way to clinical trials and applied translation implementation research. The common theme was power failure. The average power was about 20% in these studies under pretty favorable assumptions. Under more realistic assumptions was something like 8%. So you expect in a very underpowered environment to have lots of false negative situations. You cannot discover interesting signals, but also lots of false positives if there is a little bit of bias. And it's unavoidable that there might be some bias in most scientific fields. These are some other evaluations looking at sample size and distributions of effect sizes that we did with Dennis Seuss. And pretty much the same message here, looking in neuroscience and psychology and medical fields, both for quote-unquote positive studies and negative studies, the common denominator is very small sample size. This is looking at another evaluation in neuroimaging, where there's a very prolific literature on fMRI and clinical structural MRI imaging, this thousands of papers. We looked at papers that had been published in the creme de la creme journals. We saw the sample size has increased over time, and it's somewhere close to 25 at the moment, starting with a sample size of 5 on average in 1990. So, you know, with 5 observations, I don't know how much you can say, but, you know, these were papers that were published in the top journals. Even with 25, I think that unless you have some very specific purpose, it's very difficult to make very strong inferences. This is some work that we did in economics. Christo Kouliagis from Melbourne has collected all the meta-analysis that exist in economics, this is when we did that paper in Economic Journal. It included 130 economics topics with more than 10,000 studies and more than 70,000 effect estimates. This is the distribution of power in the top tier, and the common denominator is that economics, observational economics mostly in this case, was not really very different compared to neuroscience. Most fields in that domain had very limited power, and very few meta-analyses had several studies that would be well-powered to detect what would be meaningful, at least modest effects of interest. Big data are overcoming the problem of power. The problem here is that we are overpowered, so everything will be statistically significant. Unless we pay attention to what I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of great opportunities, but also the problems of big noise and big errors. And we saw that very prominently during the COVID-19 pandemic with tons of data circulating and with hundreds of thousands of papers being published, you know, lots of them with very, very tentative data. There's a number of empirical studies in different fields where replication practices are already common. So, you know, people do replication, and they suggest that most of the initially claimed statistically significant effects are either false positives or substantially exaggerated. You know, the effect size may be exaggerated compared to the true signal. It doesn't mean that there's no signal that is completely null, but it's probably much smaller. This is some early work that I did in genetics at the time that we were switching from testing one or a few hypotheses at a time, which is the candidate gene approach, which is the way that we do science in most scientific fields. You know, we have some specific hypotheses or small set of hypotheses that we try to filter very carefully because we don't have the resources to look at more than that. Versus the stage where we went into agnostic mode. We had big platforms that we could measure the entire genome. So instead of thinking of one gene or a few variants thereof, we could look at the entire genome. So we could go back and see, well, what happened to the papers that we had published, you know, tens of thousands of papers in the Candida gene era in journals like Nature and Science and Lancet and New England Journal of Medicine and the best genetics journals, claiming that we have identified genes that are associated with specific diseases or phenotypes. And the replication rate was 1.2%. So maybe a little bit of that may be due to the inability to have perfect power. If you know that genetic signal is an odds ratio of 1.01, obviously even with very large genetic association studies and sequencing studies, we would not be able to find it. But that's worrisome. You know, maybe it's not 1.2%, it's 5% or 10%, but most of the signals could not be replicated. Is a classic paper that appeared in 2015 on psychology. 271 psychologists and their teams joined forces to try to see if 100 papers published in the creme de la creme journals in the field could be reproduced. They tried to follow what the original authors had done very carefully, tried to reach out to them to make sure that they're as faithful as possible. And this is how it looked like, the original studies and the replication, p-values and effect sizes. Depending on how you read the results, you can get a different conclusion, but roughly 1 out of 3 studies might not be reproduced if you ask for a statistically significant p-value. I'm not saying that this is really the way that you should read them, but that's one way. And the effect sizes on replications were 60% lower compared to the original. There have been many such efforts recently. It has become kind of an industry of reproducibility checks. And psychology, for example, that led the way now is into a massive mode with multi-labs and multi-labs 2 and 3, where some topics are targeted by a large number of reproducibility teams. And then they join forces, they perform a meta-analysis to try to see whether the original signal survives or not. This is another early effort in economics, looking at experimental economics with practically randomized trials. did a bit better compared to psychology, with about a 30% quote-unquote failure rate. Again, you know, the definitions have to be seen with a grain of salt. Other efforts subsequently looking at broader sets of economics seem to perform much worse than that. What if I only read Nature and Science, the best journals, very carefully vetted, so competitive to publish there, social science papers published in Science and Nature with reproducibility efforts. About half of the effect size survives in the reproducibility versus the original paper. Some effect sizes completely disappear, some others stay there a bit less or substantially less compared to the original. Can we tell which would disappear and which ones would still be somehow there? Maybe to some extent, but not much. These are prediction markets that have been set up by Anna Drebber and several of my colleagues. So you can start just by flipping a coin and say this is going to reproduce or not reproduce. That's not going to get you very far. Probably it's going to be 50% success rate. Or you can ask experts. That will do better. They may be successful in predicting successful reproducibility about 65% of the time. Or you can ask prediction markets where you give people money to play with and bet on what will be reproducible versus what will not. And then they do a bit better. The AUC goes to 0.7 or so, so, you know, maybe a 70% success rate. Now, these are mostly experiments in psychology and social sciences. Maybe there is some insider knowledge, but maybe people know that, oh, I have tried that, it didn't work. Oh, really? So I can bet my money in something else. In some other fields, probably there's no such insider knowledge. Especially I can think of many biomedical fields where everything is agnostic. There's no reason to believe that one gene would be better than another. You know, all genes are equal. There's democracy in genome-wide and sequencing studies, real democracy. I think prediction markets would not behave necessarily better than that 50% success rate of random toss. But the bottom line is that it's not easy to tell ahead of time that what might survive and what might be not reproducible. The whole business leads to a lot of tension. And we have seen what I call the reproducibility wars, meaning that people feel very uneasy to see that their research is refuted. I have no problem with that. I think most of my research probably is wrong, so it should be refuted. You're welcome to try to refute me. I would be grateful for your effort to waste your life with my miserable work. But most of the time when people say, I didn't see what you published, and you know that might be the paper that made their career, they feel very uneasy about it. And in the early days, we saw a lot of animosity about, so you mean that I'm a bad scientist, you mean that I'm a fraud, you mean that I should lose my job, or, and the bottom line is that we're not talking about fraud here. Yes, there is fraud, and I will show you a little bit that might be heading in that direction, but most of the time, it's just the fact that research is so difficult. It's so difficult to do, to design, to report. We're biased, you know, we focus on things that we like the most, that look better, you know, they shine more, but this is not necessarily gold. And it doesn't mean that we're bad scientists if something does not reproduce. So I think there's a little bit less animosity, but each time I see a new field moving into that reproducibility mode, there's much of that deja vu of people claiming that, no, I'm a good scientist, you know, my research has to be right. There's a lot of resistance to refutation. We had noticed that a long time ago, and we see that again with the new wave of reproducibility efforts. So this is a paper that we published 15 years ago in JAMA with Athena Datsionis and Nikos Bonitsis when I was in Ioannina. And basically we took some of the most squarely refuted findings in medicine with very large randomized trials showing absolutely no benefit. Like, you know, beta carotene had been proposed as the most effective chemopreventive intervention in a paper in Nature in 1980. And that paper got cited thousands of times. Then there were six very large randomized trials done, and none of them showed any benefit. If anything, they showed a trend for harm, and the confidence intervals completely exclude the possibility of any benefit. But nevertheless, the paper on beta-carotene, the Nature paper in 1980, continued to be very heavily cited after these refutations were published. And in that case, the refutations were not even citing the negative, quote-unquote, randomized trials. They would just say beta-carotene is a very chemo-preventive agent, and therefore, in this paper, we study some extract of beta-carotene to treat tumors in the tails of rats. And you know, that literature gets perpetuated forever. There's a group that will not let go, no matter what. Recently, we tried to see what happens if you have quote-unquote refutations in the setting of multi-lab, multiple teams performing experiments in psychology and social sciences and not showing any effect. Do people continue to cite the original papers that had claimed the effect? For example, ego depletion, the classic paper that received 2,000 citations when we did that analysis, had 67 participants worth of sample size. The reproducibility efforts were 23 teams, and cumulatively they had more than 2,000 sample size. The effect size originally was 2.05, you know, D of 2.05. It's like amazing. I'm not sure I have ever found myself a D of 2.05. You know, maybe I'm envious about this. And the replication efforts are 0.04 with confidence intervals from minus 0.07 to 0.15. So, and then you have facial feedback, money priming, flag priming, and so forth, pretty much similar. All the effect sizes in the replication were 0.04, 0.03, 0.01, 0.01, and very tight confidence intervals. And this is how citations went for these papers. They were not really affected. In a few cases, they even continued to escalate at a higher pace compared to before the refutation that you see here with the arrow. And in terms of what these citations were about, it was not citations that said, you know, by the way, this has not been reproduced. You know, multiple teams tried to do this and it didn't reproduce. Most of these citations just say, this is so, and you know, we continue doing work on this. Very rarely they engage with the enemy to say that, well, by the way, you know, these nasty multi-lab people, you know, didn't find this, but we have strong arguments to believe that the original signal was correct. Most of the time it's just, we continue doing our work. We don't care about even dealing with a refutation. So this means to me that once you have something that is quote unquote false, it can get embedded in the scientific literature. It has its own followers, it has its own meetings, its own journals, its own societies, its own departments, its own teams, its own legacy that will continue to reverberate. Along with Dan, we published that paper in PNAS a few years ago, where we tried to look at meta-analysis across different scientific fields. This is a nice opportunity. If you have meta-analysis, it means that someone else has decided that you have multiple studies that are looking at the same thing or similar enough that they would put the studies together. And this is some sort of reproducibility effort. So then you can say, does the pattern of the results look like compatible with any of these 18 different types of biases? For example, small study effects. The small studies show bigger effect sizes compared to the large studies. And why is that? Well, there could be many explanations. Maybe it's genuine diversity, but it could be that small studies, if they don't find a nice looking result, they're easier to disappear. Conversely, a large study, you know, it's very difficult to hide. It's a big elephant. You cannot hide that under the carpet. So you will see then smaller studies having exaggerated average effect sizes. And gray literature, for example, thesis versus journal papers, or decline effect, early work showing maybe smaller, larger effect sizes, and then smaller effect sizes emerging, or Proteus, early extremes, where you see a big effect, it's published in a big journal, everyone wants to challenge it, so within a year or two, you have a window of opportunity of publishing a paper in a major journal. You can find that, oh, by the way, that Nature paper was wrong, and here's something that's completely opposite. And then maybe the literature stabilizes somewhere in the middle. So we found some evidence for most of these biases in most scientific fields, but very heterogeneous. Some fields had more of this or that, and others had more of some The bias, for example, small study effects tend to be on average more prominent in the social sciences, a bit less in the biomedical sciences, not prominent in the physical sciences. Physical sciences, maybe they don't have small sample size problems. You know, they have these telescopes that they can have all the data that they want, or it could be other explanations. Each field would be nice to know what are the biases that empirically have hints of existence so that they can deal with or preemptively try to consider them. All of that is with the assumption that what we see published, what we see available in the literature, original, reproducibility, whatever, is a faithful record of the data that the investigator has seen, or maybe not even the investigator has seen, but some sponsor maybe has seen, some statistician hopefully has seen, you know, someone who has analyzed the data has seen. Now, this can also be challenged. This is one paper in the BMJ that reanalyzed the study U329. It sounds like a submarine, but it's actually a trial on antidepressants in adolescents. And the original study had been analyzed by the sponsor, Smith, Klein, Beecham. It had been published as showing that paroxetine and imipramine, two antidepressants, are very effective and very safe in adolescents. And then independent investigators got hold of their own data and they reanalyzed them and they said, nope, they're not effective and they're not safe. So now who do you believe? It's the same data set. And how often has this happened? Well, we tried to look at how many reanalyses had been published. This is a paper we published in JAMA several years ago. Not that many, but about a third, a bit over a third, had concluded a different conclusion compared to the original by reanalyzing the very same data on the same outcomes. So the original said this medication works. The reanalysis said it doesn't, or it works in different people. Who were these rogue analysts? Most of the time, they were the original authors who reanalyzed their paper and came up with a different conclusion. If they came up with the same conclusion, nobody would want to publish it. So they had to come up with a new message, even though it was very confusing. It's the same data, you look at the same outcome. Yeah, but I'm looking from a different twist here, and I have a new Bayesian whatever, I don't know. And now we're completely confused. Many more meta-analyses have happened, and I bet they found the same results and nobody cared to report them. But this is still a very small number if we think that we have 200 million papers and about 2 million randomized trials, and there's only 30-something of them that have been reanalyzed. So can we get more of this? Along with Tom Hardwick, we have started what we call the Data Ark project from NOAA's Ark. So NOAA tried to salvage a pair of all the animal species in his Ark, and we tried to do the same for all the highly cited paper across science. So we started from psychology and psychiatry, and now we have moved on to all social sciences. We hope we will publish the results pretty soon, even though they don't look very nice for social sciences, to be honest. Forget that. What we said, we got the most highly cited papers in the last 10 years, and we went to the principal investigators, the corresponding authors, who said, you have done this amazing work that's so influential, and the legacy needs to stay. We will curate these data sets and make them available for everyone. No need to give us any money. We will do all the effort. We'll spend our time and resources to curate the database and make them available. And some did give us the data. Some others had already given the data to the wider scientific community and to the public, but most did not. And the reason that most did not was that it was, in most cases, outside of the researcher's control. So, for example, trials that were sponsored by the industry, the principal investigator never had control of the data, never saw the data, never analyzed the data. Some statistician at the company analyzed the data, wrote up the paper, sent it to the, you know, Harvard, Stanford, LSE professor or whatever, and put their names. I'm not saying that it was completely gift or ghost authorship, but never really had control of the data. So how can we get that? How can we get these data if we really have concerns that I need to see them, I need to trust them, I need to go back to the origins of the scientific method, Royal Academy of Sciences, you need to go there and show your apparatus working in front of the other academicians. Many journals have tried to improve the situation. For example, the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors for a number of years now has made a decision that
to publish your paper, you need to have a data statement saying where the data is, how to access them, when are they going to be shared with whom and how. And indeed, when we looked at the top journals like Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, BMJ, Annals of Internal Medicine, most of the time there was some statement there. Individual level data, about half. Some repository that was committed, about 20%. The identified individual level data in the repository, very, very few. And if you want the data right now, only 2 out of 500 trials, roughly. You could get the data right now with no vetting, with no extra approvals, without waiting for 1 year or 10 years. John Carlyle, an editor of Anesthesia, has had the hobby, it's a bad hobby, of asking for the raw data for every single trial that comes to the Journal of Anesthesia, that he's the editor, one of the editors, and he has looked at a large number of trials. He has concluded that about 30 to 40% of the trials submitted to that journal, which is the best journal in anesthesia, you know, in Britain and one of the top in the world, are so wrong that he called these zombie trials. So it's either fraud or someone who has no clue what they're doing. So if you see, like, every patient has the same bilirubin, 1.6, 1.6, 1.6, 1.6, 1.6. That's not likely to be real. Or if you see a whole spreadsheet copied in 5 different places across the data, that's very problematic. So is it fraud or is it just glaring incompetence? Could be either or, but he called them zombie trials. And I wrote that editorial when he published his experience, arguing that if you have the same percentages in other fields as you have in anesthesia, then about 500,000 randomized trials are a zombie. So we have hundreds of thousands of zombie randomized trials circulating among us. I published that on a Halloween date, I think very appropriately. And that's not what I thought. I have to be honest, I never thought that that would be so bad. I thought that was mostly good efforts, but not really so horrible, but that looks really horrible. Now, as science is moving on, we have more science, which is good, but we don't necessarily have better quality science. For example, during the COVID-19 pandemic, everybody rose to the occasion to fight a major crisis that was out there, and you know, I'm a scientist, I need to do something about it, I will work on COVID-19. So this is an analysis that we did, that we published last year, looking at how many scientists had published any Scopus Index papers within the first year and a half, and we found that 720,000 scientists within 1 year published on COVID-19. They covered all 174 fields of science in that work, and automobile engineering was the last domain to fall in December of 2020. Until that time, no automobile engineer had published anything on COVID-19. It happened, you know, at the end of the year. Now, these papers are not about automobile engineering. You know, they're not about how to protect yourselves by wearing a seatbelt while, you know, there's a COVID pandemic. It's epidemiology, you know, done by automobile engineers. And you know, one might wonder whether this can be done lege artis, even under the best circumstances. This is another paper that we published recently in PNAS, looking at what we call the massive COVIDization of research and the creation of a new citation elite. We found that 98 of the top 100 papers published in 2020 across all science were on COVID-19, which is entirely amazing. If you have a very hot field, you would expect maybe 2 or 3 papers across all science to belong to that field. Now it was 98 out of 100. So we have the challenges of being too successful. And I feel responsible for that because I have also polluted heavily the literature with my paper. So I'm thinking, how can I get a little bit back of that tremendous pollution that I have contributed and make some amends? These are some possibilities of how to make amends. Large-scale collaboration, adoption of replication culture, registration at multiple levels of studies, protocols, analysis codes, data sets, raw data, results, sharing of data protocols, material software, and other tools, reproducibility checks like the ones that I showed you, containment of conflicted sponsors and authors. I didn't mention much about conflicts, but it is there. More appropriate statistics, standardizing definitions and analysis, having the community agree on how to do things, more stringent thresholds, but there's pros and cons about this for claiming success, improving study design standards, improving peer review, reporting, dissemination of research, and better training at all levels, you know, that statistics, design, method, reproducibility as well. How much sharing is happening? Over the last 30 years, this is looking at millions of papers in the entire PubMed Central open access. You see a lot of darkness around the globe. No country is sharing much. How about protocol registration? Again, lots of darkness around the world. There's a little bit of light in Africa because of some international collaborations that do share protocols ahead of time. Some communities have changed that pattern. These are data based on 30 years worth of data. For example, 2.5 years ago, we published that paper in Science where with 71 authors and probably many more echoing the same feelings, we argued that for genomic data, if they're publicly funded, they should be available for everyone immediately. Not wait for the data generator to publish a paper based on that little piece or slice of data that they generated, because that will be misleading compared to the totality of the evidence that could be analyzed, giving credit to each data generator and to other people who contributed, and getting some bigger picture that may be more reliable. Some journals have moved towards the direction of saying that, no, we don't want just a data statement, but if you have a clinical trial, if you're, it's going to appear in us, in BMJ or PLOS Medicine, we want to see the full data available to anyone who asked for them. So we did ask for them, and about 50% of the investigators gave us their data, and we reanalyzed, so we told them that this is what we're gonna do. It's like getting an IRB audit. That nasty person, Johnny Nees, who says that most research is false, is asking for my data, goodness. But still, they gave the data. And every single situation, we got the same results with very minor deviations compared to what had been published. Of course, this is the most transparent authors in the most transparent journals in the most sharing environment. But to me, it says that we can have environments and authors and settings where we can have full trust in the results that are being published. Sharing is going up over the years. This is some survey that we did with random samples from the biomedical literature over 20 years, and this is a paper that we published last year led by Stelios Argiou, where we looked again at the entire open access PubMed Central, which is a very large number of papers, and we saw that clearly data sharing is happening more frequently. It seems to be leveling off in the last few years at about 20% though. Code sharing is still uncommon. It's just a couple percent. Protocol registration, a little bit more, but still in the range of 4-5%. Very clear improvements in conflict of interest disclosures, although most of the time it's just that no conflict of interest, and then you have to wonder whether this is correct or not. Pretty good performance in funding disclosures. Again, we don't know whether that's complete or not. Most papers claim that they have something novel to say, and few, but increasing numbers say that they have some replication component. Now, this is what they say. It doesn't mean that it has happened necessarily, but probably in most cases, it's fairly accurately representing what has happened. This is another view of the same data. This is a view looking at the universe of science. These are maps of science where each dot is a subfield. And if you see color, that means that that subfield is adopting that transparency or reproducibility practice. So you see that these practices are adopted by different fields. Data sharing and code sharing have a little bit of overlap, but there's many fields that share data but don't share code. Protocol registration happens in different fields compared to those that share code. There's very little overlap between the two. And I wish that we could see more color for all of these maps. This is looking at journal ranking. If you take a look at the top left, there's one journal that shares data from more than 75% of the papers that they publish, and there's many, many that share none of any of the papers that they published. Code sharing, the best performance is about 30-something percent, and the vast majority have no papers that share their code and so forth. In some fields, sharing and transparency is more difficult to achieve. For example, artificial intelligence and complex computational methods are more challenging, but it can be done. 2 years ago, we published that in Nature, where we give instructions and recommendations on how you could make a very complex computational environment very transparent in people understanding what has happened and resurrecting that dinosaur and making it live again. Complex computation was very common during the pandemic. Models that were published in the last 2 years outnumber the models that were performed in the last 20 years and more. Transparency did not improve much. Most of that research, the code and or the data were not available. There's a lot of exceptions nevertheless, and I think that we need more of this. Then there is a countercurrent which suggests that maybe sharing is not a good thing. Maybe we should keep things in a stealth mode from a financial perspective. Companies, startups feel uneasy about sharing their strengths. The classic example was Theranos. I was the first to write a negative paper about Theranos, and then I heard from their general counsel, why am I attacking them? And I should repent and write a favorable paper with their CEO, Elizabeth Holmes, saying that now I'm convinced, I've seen the light. As you know, the whole enterprise collapsed shortly thereafter. It's not Theranos alone. There's many, many companies that just don't want to publish. They don't want to show data. They don't want to go through peer review. They just want to go to venture capitalists, get the money. They can convince them that they do something important. We looked at all unicorns in healthcare, and we saw that many of them look like Theranos, even though they haven't gone bust like Theranos. Along with leading scientists in immunology, we did the same thing for startups that work in immunology, and we saw that again, there was, if anything, an inverse correlation between the valuation of the startup and how much evidence it had published. You know, if you publish no evidence, you can have a high valuation. Everybody thinks that what you do is amazing. If you start publishing, people say that this is probably not as spectacular as it might be. Better statistics and better methods can make a difference. I can probably spend many more hours, and it's already very late, but we need to find ways to improve training and literacy and numeracy across the scientific workforce. Currently, most people use p-values. In a text mining exercise, we found that if you have p-values in biomedical papers, this is millions of papers in abstracts and about a million papers in full text that we analyze, 96% of the time they claim statistically significant results. So, compared to when p-values were first proposed by R.A. Fisher, they had some discrimination ability. Now they have close to none. Or very little. Some practices like randomization and blinding of the assessment of outcomes in vitro studies, they cost nothing, they should be ubiquitous, but nevertheless, they're not done. Computational methods, I showed you the example of artificial intelligence, can be improved clearly. Complexity is not a reason not to be transparent, even though it takes a little bit more effort to be transparent. So at the end of the day, this is an evolving situation, and I think we can imagine some evolution in Darwinian space. Maybe there's also a revolution going on in some fields more than in others. We published that manifesto of reproducible science with many good colleagues a couple of years ago, identifying all these steps where threats occur, but also opportunities arise to try to improve reproducibility. And it's not just up to scientists, of course, it's up to funders, it's up to journals, publishers, the general public can make a difference. We can help, perhaps, to streamline the process. This is a consensus-based transparency checklist for social sciences that we published recently in Nature Human Behavior. There's a long version with 36 items and a shorter version with 12 items. And peer review can be improved. Last month, we had the International Congress on Peer Review and Scientific Publication in Chicago. We had great ideas about how peer review is failing and some ideas about how peer review may be improved. I think some of them may work, but we need to follow up on them. Eventually, I think we are all in the same boat. We all want to get things right. I think we all acknowledge that we may not be right all the time. I think I'm wrong most of the time, but hopefully I have good feedback from other scientists, from other evidence, so I can correct my mistakes. How do we give more incentives to people who want to get things right eventually? Maybe we need to re-engineer the reward system. Maybe we need to pay more attention, not just to productivity. We have 200 million papers. We don't need necessarily more, although I have nothing against productivity. I'm a, you know, workaholic. I write papers like crazy. If you tell me don't write papers, I don't know, I will go even more crazy. So don't do that for me. But we need to pay more attention to quality, to reproducibility, to sharing, and to translational potential, making things that would work in real life. And this means that we need to infuse these incentives and criteria towards how we hire, promote, and offer tenure to scientists. This is some ideas that we put together in a paper in PLOS Biology recently, and there's others who are working on implementation of these ideas because they're not there in the official documents yet. Along with Danielle Rice and David Moher, we looked at 92 medical faculties around the world. Very rarely these ideas were in the official documents of what do you look when you recruit or promote or offer tenure. Now, many of these documents were probably written in the 18th century, you know, revised in 1964, who knows. Administrative manuals take a long time to revise. More of that is happening in real life, in real promotions, in real recruitments. As people discuss about that in surveys. People are concerned about reproducibility and transparency. Nature has done such surveys. So I'm not pessimistic, and I'm also not pessimistic about recruiting interest from all of these other stakeholders beyond scientists who may have different viewpoints on why they're engaged in science. They're engaged because they want to publish, because they want to see their work funded, because they want to see things translated, because they want to make profit if it's companies. We need to find ways to align these stakeholders' interests. To conclude, science is the best thing that has happened to humans, and we need to invest more in research, especially high quality. Not sure I told you what high quality is. I'm still searching for it, but yes, high quality reproducible research. The reproducibility of many disciplines of scientific investigation has substantial room for improvement. There's many possible interventions on how to do that. We can improve efficiency of research practices. We can improve reproducibility. We can improve, hopefully, utility of the evidence for applied fields. Transparency and openness seem to be important. The devil is in the details, so details on how to are important and need to be very carefully dissected. And just be aware that the landscape is changing very rapidly. So maybe much of what I told you today is just false. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that presentation. So before we open it up for questions, I guess I'll take the first question because I'm really fascinated by this topic you've just given. And one question is the role of industry and the who is actually sponsoring the research and what interests those entities bring into this research. And you haven't said much about this in your talk, and I would be very curious to hear more about this.
There's tons of studies looking at conflicts of interest and let's say quantitative measures of effect sizes and quality indicators. And in the early literature, conflicts of interest and sponsorship by the industry tended to be heavily associated with worse quality and with inflated effect sizes. For a number of years now, this has disappeared on average. I'm talking about average because obviously studies could be all over the place. And it may have even been replaced by an opposite trend. And there may be different explanations for that. One explanation might be that the industry spends so many tens of billions of dollars on research. They want to make even more out of this. And they spend even more on marketing, of course. Among big pharma, all big pharma, with maybe one exception, they spend more on marketing than on research. But still, they spend a lot. So if you spend a lot and you want to make even more, you will not come up with designs, protocols, or papers that some crazy person like Johnny Anides or Hussein Nasi, we look at it, look at this, you know, you have failed in the design. You know, you will try to satisfy these checklists and the regulatory requirements and what people say you will be checked. You know, it's like these are the questions that you will be asked in the exam. So you need to know the answers very well for those. Now, does this mean that this research is necessarily better, you know, generally better? I said that quality is a term that is very difficult to define. And if there's other aspects that are even more important, like the research agenda, like the very first question, do I even need a new drug for this? Do I even need treatment for this? Maybe it's a condition that, you know, there should be no market. Maybe I have just expanded the market by creating a new diagnosis, by expanding the spectrum of the diagnostic criteria so that now everybody has that disease. And, you know, I feel fine, but if I look to the definitions, I have 25 diseases that I need to be treated. And I have then these trials that fulfill the checklist that tell me that I need to be taking 50 drugs right now that I'm talking to you. So there's other layers where I think the industry can make a difference. And then we have interventions at the level outside the scientific literature that may subvert the scientific literature. So for example, you can have interventions at the level of education, of outreach, of patient involvement. You can have patient groups, which I think is a wonderful idea, become activists in favor of more drugs and more treatment and more of this, because we are dying and we need more of that. And, you know, what can you say? You're dying, of course, yes. But by the way, you're misled, or maybe you're paid by the industry to say so. At the level of affecting pricing, affecting healthcare expenditures, claiming that this is a top priority for our society and we need to invest $5 trillion. COVID-19 stimulus in the US was $5 trillion. Good choice, I don't know. You're the economist, you will tell me. So there's many levels that, going beyond the checklist level of quality, conflicts can make a difference. And I don't want to demonize disclosures, because someone may make disclosures that they're related in zillions of ways to the industry, and they may be great scientists, and maybe the science is really great, but we need at least disclosures to know who is doing what and why, at a minimum. And then perhaps, you know, there's nothing wrong with these disclosures.
Thank you for that. Thank you. Any questions from the audience? Yeah, there's one.
Thank you so much for that. That was incredibly interesting. I have two questions with varying levels of seriousness. The first one's more serious. A lot of the characteristics that you talked about, it seems like one could map a trajectory and map out where different disciplines are on. And I was just wondering whether you'd be able to speak to certain disciplines. You know, you should look at what they're doing at the moment, because they're you in 10 years' time, and actually speed up the process of the quality improvement. And the second question is, given that knowledge itself isn't stable and everything that you've just presented, do we know anything?
Oh, goodness. So the first question, I think that disciplines can learn from each other. And I think that interdisciplinarity can help scientists from different fields communicate and learn about what each field is doing and how they're doing things. And sometimes there may be some wonderful ideas that have not been implemented in some other field, and that's a good opportunity to start using them. Ideas about research practices tend to arise here and there over time. And to give you one example, recently with one of my colleagues who comes from the psychological sciences, we were writing a paper about a peer review in early stages, and he said, well, we have register reports that have started in psychological sciences. Some cognitive journals did that for the first time in 2012, and they're not yet used in biomedical science. And I said, well, by the way, Lancet in the early 1990s had a practice that was pretty much the same as register reports, meaning that you submit your protocol, the protocol is reviewed in depth, and you have provisional acceptance that the paper will be published based on that protocol if you complete the study, and of course you don't deviate from what you promised. So that was there in the 1990s, and it was abandoned after a number of years, and people in psychological science had never heard that, you know, biomedical science had tried that, and it went that far. Or issues of peer review. There's very different modes. Some fields have one way of peer reviewing, and others have a different way of peer reviewing. Preprints in the physical sciences started in the 1990 range or so. Very quickly, they became dominant. It was the norm, it is the norm, to publish in archive, and you may or may not publish in a journal as well, but this is enough if you have it in preprints and you have more than a million papers in physical sciences in archive. It took 20 plus years to get it started in biomedicine. It took the COVID pandemic to see done a bit more routinely. So fields can learn. Does it mean that if a research practice is transplanted to a different field, it will work? Not necessarily. It may be a very bad idea. And this means that these research practices still need to be vetted. If something worked in physics, it doesn't mean that it will necessarily work in medicine or vice versa. Now, can we learn anything? Goodness, I mean, that's a very deep question, and it goes back to philosophy of science. You will hear all sorts of answers on this from philosophers who knew far more than I do, and who thought a lot more than I do. I'm probably more of the empirical school, which means that I still keep my curiosity, but I'm also interested in getting things done and getting things to work. And given my medical background, I believe that people do die. I don't think it's fake. So if I can make them live longer, and if I can improve their quality of life, and I can make them live better lives, more happier lives, you know, mental health, for example, that's really big. So I don't care if it's true, false, half true. If it works, I use that utilitarian approach, empirical utilitarian. It's something that I think is a solid goal to achieve. Now, in other days, I'm more in my poetic philosophical mode, so I would say, no, there's nothing, it's just all waste, and why don't we commit suicide? No.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Amazing, incredible presentation. My doubt is primarily concerning, I'm not sure if you've already conducted studies on that. What would you comment on the geographic distribution of the kind of issues that you've pointed out? I know it's a very broad question, but the situation, at least the research situation in the West, is not the same as the research situation. I'm from India, so I think it's quite different. And also the kind of research contributions of different professions. I'm a medical doctor from India, so I know that, back in India, biomedical sciences, professionals are at least not as much involved in research as much as it is in the West. So how did that, or did that ever come up as an issue?
That's a very important question, and I stayed clear of any geographical analysis, but there's a number of such analyses that have been done. Some also by my team, looking at biases that may have some preponderance of some geographic structure, more prominent in some countries versus others, and some research practices that are more heavily adopted along with their biases or their protection from bias in some countries than in others. It's a huge literature, and I don't want to try to summarize it. In essence, there's no good and bad countries. It's not that the Americans are bad or the Americans are good. We published a paper with Dan saying the Americans are bad in PNAS, and Americans hated us for that, but we were attacked by the Europeans for this, isn't it? A good colleague of us, who was a very good friend, thought that, no, your conclusions are not what it should be. But we had found, so it seems, that American studies tended to have more extreme effects, in both directions, maybe because Americans had stronger pressure to publish extreme results to get funded, but now everybody has pressure to publish strong signals to get funded. We have seen other patterns. For example, China is skyrocketing its productivity in some fields. I'm very much interested in meta-analysis, so I have watched the meta-analysis literature. At some point, I saw China skyrocketing like this, and US was going like that, and Europe pretty much the same. And most of these meta-analyses, sorry to say, they look perfect based on the checklist. So if I took my checklist, done, done, done. They're even citing me. You know, I got thousands of citations from these papers. Goodness, they were all wrong. You know, I got thousands of citations from wrong papers. So I'm not sure whether that's a good credit to say. Why were they wrong? Because the basic question was completely irrelevant any longer. For example, there were thousands of genetic epidemiology meta-analyses on Canada gene genetics, which we know now they have 1.2% replication rate. But if you just get the bits and pieces that had been published and get them together, all of them give significant results. If you look at very large data sets that are 20 times bigger, none of them give any signals. India has its own pattern, you know, of again, very rapidly rising productivity. Many countries are going through some very perverse incentives. They're trying to catch up. They try to become dominant in the scientific world. China, the salary of academics and of researchers is based on what they publish. If you publish a paper in Nature, you get, I don't remember exactly, like 30 times your basic salary. It's a crazy world out there. We have created a database of citation metrics, which we try to update every year with the top cited scientists across all fields. We have about 200,000 scientists worth of data there. And I get hundreds of emails from people asking me very weird questions like, you know, how can I become heavily cited? You know, we have some very weird patterns, and I do worry that sometimes by making all these metrics available making research so quantifiable, these perverse incentives get even worse. I don't know how to stop it, but it can get worse. We have big biases. I said that I don't believe that fraud is as common as these questionable research practices, but in some cases we have florid fraud. We know that there's many teams that massively produce fraudulent papers. We know that there's paper mills. There's companies practically who you can go to buy papers that have your name. There's so much happening in the world of science that is threatening. I mean, we don't know how many of these trends, many of which have local character or strong local character. Some of them might become more mainstream. I mean, if they just affect little bits and pieces of the scientific enterprise, maybe it's not such a big deal. But I worry that many of them are becoming more mainstream. We have predatory journals. I mean, I can talk forever about how things can go wrong in very, very basic ways.
Thank you. What's your view on the use of preprints and let's say the new dogma of first publishing, then get your work reviewed by others, mm-hmm. notifying others, as a way of modernizing the existing, possibly outfashioned or outdated, you know, peer-reviewed academic journals and the business surrounding this?
So preprints I have been very much in favor of, and we've seen a growth of preprints also in the non-physical sciences in the last several years. Both biomedicine and social sciences use more preprints than they used to. And in principle, I think it's a good idea because you have more visibility, you have more transparency, you have earlier availability of what that paper is or is evolving to. More opportunities for peer review by more reviewers than what you would get in a typical journal where you have 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 reviewers, but this is it. Does it work in most situations? Probably not. And most preprints don't get any attention. No one is really looking at them carefully, and no one is making sensible, useful reviewer comments. There's a lot of empirical studies, and we've done some of them. We're also looking at an umbrella review of all of them, looking at improvements from the preprint stage to the final publication. If I were to summarize them, there are changes, but they're not that many. And they're not such that change the machinery of the paper. In a way, once a paper is written, it's it's almost doomed to be published. Drummond Rennie used to say that, and the late Doug Altman, that anything can be published if you just decide to write it. It may not be published in Nature, but it will be published. So I'm in favor of preprints, and I think that they have these advantages. They're just one additional piece in the chain of documentation and evidence and transparency. So I think we need to experiment with them a bit more and try to see whether we can improve them also, whether we can get them linked to some other transparency practices like sharing of data, code, registration. It's an open frontier.
Thanks.
Hi, it was an amazing talk. I feel really inspired right now. Sorry, that was really cliche. But I just want to go back to the topic of incentives. So I may draw from my personal experience. In the research lab I used to work in, my supervisor tend to spend a lot of time on grant application. And also for them, it's a real incentive to publish as many papers as possible because they don't. Their next grant may be dependent on if the current result will be published in the paper. So I was really interested to see at the end of your talk that you brushed through the idea of aligning the interests of the stakeholders. Could you kind of expand on what you mean by that?
So this is a very central question on how to do this. And of course, there's so many stakeholders that the details matter, and I think that they can depend on local circumstances, on the structure of funding, and how research institutions work, and who is doing what, and what kind of allocation of labor there is between industry and academia and research institutes. So I don't have a simple answer to say, you know, this is the magic way to do it. But the basic principle is that there's so many people and so many institutions and organizations and sponsors interested that if they agree on how things should be done, there could be more efficiency. I mean, some things are redundant and probably they could be streamlined. Some other things are not transparent, and maybe by making them transparent at one stage, everyone else benefits downstream. For example, a peer review. Who is peer reviewing at the moment? You have peer review by sponsors, by funders, by peers, if you want to ask your peers. You have peer review by institutional review boards. You have the standard journal type of peer review. You have the preprint, visibility, social media, who knows. And you have multiple journals peer reviewing. Each one of them typically does not know what the other journals have done. So we have very poor peer review, but we have a lot of peer review, and all of that is done, almost all, but with no money for those who review. So we have overburdened reviewers at all of these stages, all of these organizations, all of these structures, with very little communication among them. So I'm not telling that I know exactly how all of these could be linked together, but thinking about all the players who are in the chain of the flow of information and of vetting research probably could help. Some stakeholders are more powerful than others, so you also need to have checks in place so that they don't absorb the system. Okay, currently, I think industry, for example, is just too powerful, and academia is just too weak. And too interrelated with industry, and it's very easy to be completely absorbed. So you need to make sure that these stakeholders are aligned, but also they maintain their independence in what is essential to be independent. And then it may be different in Europe, it may be different in the UK, it may be different in the US, even for the same applications, although very often there are similar patterns, you know, like how Medicines UK and EMA and
FDA might function. There are similarities, but also dissimilarities on what they do.
Thank you. First of all, great. Always great to see you talk. It's so inspiring and so informative, and one catches up with so much that's happening at the frontier of meta research, most of which, indeed, is led by you, not coincidentally.
Okay, so. That's not good.
But so actually, another quick question came to mind as we were talking now, so I'll cheat and sneak in two questions. One, actually, on the same point about the stakeholders, to what extent do you think that monopolies in general might be a problem? So monopolies in, for example, handing down funding to researchers, and handing down, I think, is the right term, or monopolies in who holds journals and publications, and therefore who indirectly controls the literature. So that's one, just a thought that I would love to hear you expand more. The other thing that I was thinking all along, and by now I think every time I see pretty much any meta research talk really, is this issue of complexity. Now, that to me it's a little bit of the elephant in the room, and you've mentioned it a few times actually here and there. But I can't help but wonder to what extent, and this is my question to you, is complexity, in a sense, the ultimate enemy, or the wall that eventually all of this will have to hit against, or maybe not again. But and complexity, as you know, it could operate at different levels. So quite intuitively, I think there are different fields that deal with phenomena of different levels of complexity, not just sort of classic disciplines, as we try to look a little bit on physical, biological, social, but within any particular discipline, that obviously there is a great diversity of what is being looked at. Then the methods that somewhat go along with that might be of different levels of complexity, and therefore easy or less easy to sort of communicate. Then temporally, now our fields that are closer to the frontier or research that is early on, in a sense, is presumably going to be noisier and sort of harder to pin down than confirmatory research. And ultimately, over time, the argument that I remember sort of you also mentioned a few times that it could be the case that we sort of gradually, literally picking all the low-hanging fruits, and the fruits get higher and higher, and so we just, again, eventually might end up where there's no more improvement that we can make. So without saying that, of course, that this is never an argument not to improve methods, but to what extent do you think there might be an end to all this?
Yeah, no, both questions are very important. Monopolies, on philosophical grounds, I'm against monopolies. I'm not sure whether that applies to every single situation. I'm in an environment of economy, so maybe you can tell me the latest word on whether there's good situations where monopolies might be a good thing to have. You can have monopolies at different levels in science. Some of the examples of the fields that got refuted but still continue, in a way, they're monopolies, because you have a core of scientists who are untouchable by intrusion. You know, they continue within their bubble. They have their, as I said, their journals, their societies, their funding, their leadership. They just propagate that again and again, and they will not go away. You know, they continue citing the same work and building on this. So it's one sort of monopoly that is not threatened by any others. Otherwise, probably it would have been dismantled. I can't think of situations where monopolies would be a good thing. Science is benefiting, at least from my perspective, from that continuous intrusion of competitors. And some of them may have some good merchandise to sell, some good ideas, some new concepts, some good methods, some good tools, some good analysis that are better compared to the older ones. And hopefully, if that's the case, they should get the upper hand until they're also replaced by some who are even better than them. But that's very naive saying to Elsie, but that's my basic thinking on it. Now, complexity and a ceiling effect. I think that it makes sense that there should be some ceiling on how much can be achieved. And that ceiling also may be different for different disciplines and sub-disciplines. Early on, I had coined the term null fields,
which is feels that the ceiling is at the floor. So there's nothing to be discovered. And no matter if you have one scientist or a thousand scientists or a million scientists spending their best days and efforts and money and resources and tools trying to work on hypotheses and analyses and papers, if there's nothing to be discovered, nothing will be discovered. So you may get 1 million papers and nothing will come out of it. And if you have a million meta researchers trying to improve the field, they're just wasting their time and their own effort and their own funds and their own fellows and PhD and doctoral students' time, because there's nothing there. Has this happened in science? It has. I think that there are no fields out there that have nothing or close to null, that maybe they're very repetitive and people continue just using some tools that, you know, will not get you anywhere. In other fields, maybe the ceiling is much higher and, you know, much can be learned. There's far more consistency. There's more stronger signals, that the distribution of the signals has a preponderance of really important and essential and actionable and useful signals that are to be discovered and acted upon, perhaps if it's for applied science. And there probably there's plenty of room to work through the complexity and explain the complexity in a meaningful way so as to really map these signals and bring them into fruition. Now, the big problem is that each one of us working in a specific field, we feel that our field should have a high ceiling. So my bias would be to defend meta research as having, I will save the world, you know, I will save science with meta research. And maybe other people think, oh, come on, you know, this is ridiculous. What is he talking about? You know, why are we wasting our time? So I think each field legitimately thinks that their ceiling is higher, that they can make their way through complexity to a higher level of understanding and a higher level of contribution. Who is going to judge that? That's a very difficult question. You know, you need outsiders, again, to break into the monopoly of the field. They need to be knowledgeable enough to understand what is being done and tell John, you're wasting your time. You know, move on to astrophysics. You know, get a ticket to Mars. Find a better place to waste your life. But that's not easy. People don't move very easily from one field to the other. This is another meta research topic that we have some evidence on, and it's a very active field to try to map the trajectories, the phylogenetics of scientific fields and also of single scientists as they migrate across fields, perhaps to fields of better yield, hopefully, but not necessarily.
I think we're out of time, but maybe we can take the last question before we end, so sneak in another one. Right.
So I remember reading this paper of yours where you were actually going after all these hyper-prolific authors. So that's a chance for me. You are a hyper-prolific author, researcher yourself. I just looked at, you know, Google Scholar. You have 68 items, more or less, published in 2022 only. Some of these might not be journal publications, but still that's a huge number. In many of these, you are actually leading the papers or the publications, or you're a senior author or senior co-author. So first 10 months, so 300 days, so
every 4.5 days, 4.5 days, 5 days max. So, how do you do it? I mean,
yeah. Sadly, there's about 20,000 scientists who publish more papers than I do on a per time basis, and this is the reason why I did that analysis that we published in Nature a couple of years ago, because I thought that I published the most, that I pollute the literature more than anyone else. And then, you know, wake up. I mean, there's 20,000 people who publish more than you do. And I recognize that I